Hi all. I want to share the situation of Myanmar, particularly with regards to Yangon, where I'm living right now. And I think you are hearing the sound of the pots and pans banging. And this is 8 p.m. and we do it every night since the coup has begun on February 1st. Every day since the coup began, it's not good days for us anymore. Every day, protesters are being killed. And the government staff that has refused to work under the military are being arrested and being chased after. And also the NLD party members, which has won the biggest during the previous election, are being hunted as well. And some of the NLD members, they are arrested in their homes and then returned the next day, their dead bodies. So it's very, the atmosphere is just threatening in every way. The military has used so many scary tactics to scare the public off, to discourage them from going onto the streets, scare their public staff so that they would keep on continuing working. But no matter what methods they use, they have used sound bombs, they have used tear gas, they have used rubber bullets, they have used rear bullets. They flew helicopters across the sky to scare the people off. But no matter what they do, the people, we refuse to back down this time.
A dispatch from Yangon sent on Friday, 12 March, 2021. To protect her safety, we won't mention the name of the woman in the audio clip. By now, you've probably seen some of the violent scenes from the news. A dire situation is unfolding in Myanmar. On Monday, 1 February, Myanmar's military ended its decade-long experiment with democracy by launching a coup against the nation's most popular political party, the National League for Democracy, NLD, and the former Nobel Prize winner who leads it, Daw Aung San Suu Kyi. Now, Myanmar's people are on the streets, demanding the release of their leaders, demanding the restoration of the 2020 election results, and with many calling for the country's 2008 constitution to be annulled and rewritten, as it explicitly acknowledges the military's leading role in Myanmar's politics. The military has responded with violence and used all means at its disposal to quash the protests, including killing some of the protesters. But away from the news headlines, what exactly is going on in Myanmar? How are we to understand the events that began when the military tanks rolled into the streets on 1 February 2021? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. Myanmar's political history is complex. There is no shortage of explainer videos, timelines, and quick primers. But for those who have not been following the story closely over the years, it's a little difficult to get a handle on what is going on. Here at the State of Power podcast, we're interested in how coercive military power functions, how it mutates, how it is connected to other forms of power that shape the world around us. So to help us to understand what is going on in Myanmar, we reached out to today's guest on the program. Sai Samkam is an activist and scholar who left Myanmar in 2019 to begin his PhD studies in land politics, food systems, and climate change linked to Myanmar at the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague. Before he left his home country, Sai Sam was the executive director of Meta Development Foundation, an NGO that focuses on assisting communities that have been ravaged by years of internal conflict. I hoped, in my conversation with Sai Sam, to gain a deeper understanding of the story that is in the news and to place all the images and headlines in some form of context. Seeing as Myanmar is not new to military coups, having had one in 1962 and in 1988, and also seeing as there have been massive political protests before, such as the so-called Saffron Revolution of 2007, I began by asking Saisam what is particularly different about the protests this time around.
I think this protest movement in Myanmar is very unique. I would say it's a rupture of the history that we have never seen before. A lot of things are happening very quickly in a short period. Even 1988 popular uprising doesn't have a lot of these level of public mobilization. We have street protests as well as a very strong feature of this this political movement is civil disobedient movement, where the government officials start staging against the military coup, including permanent representative to the UN from Myanmar. And just recently also Myanmar ambassador to the UK also published a statement that he was appointed by Aung San Suu Kyi, and he opposes what has happened, and he also condemned the violent crackdown of the protest. So this is quite unique. It bring across people from different political and social divides to come together.
You've even got people who were in the government with important government roles also themselves saying, we support these people on the streets, essentially.
Exactly. People from the general administration department. And today you might hear the crackdown in the Myanmar railway services, you know. If you look at the salary and the social condition of these government staff, it's horrible. It's almost like slave-like condition, you know. Wow. They cannot provide even decent basic accommodation for the staff. And, you know, it's appalling to see their accommodation quarters. And today there was a violent raid. And this is for the second time raid against the railway workers. The first time is in Mandalay. And you can see that the military coup council is desperate to, you know, restore the transportation and, you know, to run the country as normal. You can really see the desperate attempt from the military.
So are we seeing any new sort of coalitions, new actors that have not been politically active before?
Yeah, basically, the analysis of this movement pointed out that, you know, the difference with the 1988 is the younger generation and the telecommunication, you know, the technologies, and you know, people can communicate with each other and then also reporting what is going on. And then there is a lot of emphasis on the younger generation, that is called Generation Z or Gen Z. Some of the narratives are a little bit, you know, elitist because they talk about the urban, more educated and middle class young people involvement in the protest. I think they are very, very important part of the protest. But then you can also see that a lot of poor young people are also involved. And if we look at the, unfortunately, the casualties, majority of them are young people. And then we are also seeing, you know, Myanmar is a very ethnocentric country, you know, the politic is about ethnic politic, you know, the country is run by the majority Burma ethnic groups and majority of them are Buddhist. So that ethnic and religious divides are very deep in Myanmar. But this protest bring different groups together. We are seeing Muslims are very much involved. Those who are killed, some of them are from the Muslim communities. And we are seeing Myanmar Chinese communities also get involved. So Indian descendants and Chinese descendants are very much discriminated in Myanmar. You know, their political contributions are always questioned by the mainstream society, despite the historical facts that both Chinese and Indian descendants and Muslims are very much involved in every political uprising in Myanmar. And now we are seeing again that people are coming together and What is very touching for me is at the highest of the Rohingya genocide in 2017, mm-hmm. you see the largest Buddhist majority in the society are supporting the military because they've seen it as a national security issue, terrorism issue, uh-huh. rather than a genocide. And now they are saying that, okay, now we understand what we've been, you know, yeah. Because we
are the general sentiment is beginning to say, we understand what was going on.
Exactly. I was, you know, in 2017, I was very desperate. I was very disappointed to see that, you know, I was thinking that, oh, when are we going to see the reality that, you know, first I thought that I will not see that people coming around mm-hmm. in my lifetime. But now I'm seeing that people are saying, we would like to sincerely apologize to the Rohingya other minority and other ethnic minority in Myanmar. We now understand what you've been through because this military can, you know, act such, you know, rude and violent right in the middle of the cities. How are they going to do that in the remote area where there is no media?
No cameras to record all that's happening.
Yeah.
And so all these people that are now coming together, you're mentioning people are finding common cause. Do you think this coming together, this coalition, this movement that is arising will be enough to turn the tide?
I think for me, for the time being, it's very difficult to assess what the future might look like. To refer to Barrington Moore's Jr.'s book, Social Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy, mm-hmm. My take on the situation in Myanmar is we are very much like the path that Barrington Moore Jr. mentioned, capitalist reactionary. In Myanmar, what we call is the crony capitalism. You know, I can see the class alliance between the military ruling class mm-hmm. and the capitalists. During the 1990s, the military opened the door a little bit and invited international investment. And then we started seeing a booming of that kind of class that is close to the military. Yeah, I'm seeing very exciting revolution going on. But on the other hand, I'm also quite concerned that where this will lead us to without military power to support us, so to say.
Yeah.
For now, we have only street protests and civil disobedient movement.
So it's really civilians unarmed coming up against a massive coercive military.
Yes, and the mass are trying to call on to international intervention, mm-hmm. UN's intervention, US intervention. But I mean, as an activist trying to support the people being displaced by war in Kachin State, starting from 2011, and then trying to stand in solidarity with the Rohingya people, with their call for international intervention. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for me to see any substantial international support coming on the way, particularly with the China and Russia in the Security Council supporting Myanmar military, you know, throughout all these years of military rule in Myanmar.
So the appetite and the desire for international community involvement is there. But yeah, when you mentioned the, because I do remember the calls for something to be done because of the Rohingya genocide, what you saw was quite a lot of like not that much movement, regardless of the images that we were seeing and the stories we were hearing. So
yeah, I think it's also kind of like people coming around, you know. During the Rohingya genocide, these are also largely the same people who say we oppose ICJ, we oppose Gambia, and we stand with Aung San Suu Kyi, who went to The Hague at the International Court of Justice to protect mm-hmm. the Myanmar military from their crime against the Rohingya people.
So I remember that was quite a big headline, and there was a lot of disappointment expressed about that. Do you share that disappointment?
Yeah, I as an activist, I share this. You know, like 2017 massive purge of the Rohingya people to Bangladesh and all these atrocities, war crimes that we hear. And then, yeah, it's very disheartening to see a democratic icon, a human rights icon, went to The Hague to protect, to defend the crimes committed by the Myanmar military. And then someone who is working for the internally displaced people in the civil war in Kachin, I've been seeing the civilians' government has acted this way many times, trying to block humanitarian aid. And also arrested and detained and arrested activists who are calling for cessation of the civil conflict, you know, and to support the displaced people.
So you would then say that what people are campaigning for is not necessarily a return to the democratic government in big air quotes as we have seen, but something even more radically democratic, something
exactly.
Focused.
Exactly. Right after the coup, people's sentiment is, yes, a lot of people who are protesting on the streets are diehard supporter of Aung San Suu Kyi. You know, they love them, they adore her, and they idolize her. Mm-hmm. But now the narrative is becoming more and more clear that, you know, there is a militarism, and then the role of the military, you know, it has to go beyond that. And then there is an awakening, you know, political awakening, understanding that, you know, we have to work for everyone, you know, that we cannot get only human rights and democracy for a certain group of people, you know.
Yeah.
Across the political divides, across the ethnic and religious divides, that people have to come together. And that's why people know that they might lose their life or their parts of their body, and they might be disabled for life, but still people are going out on the street for that same reason, because there is an understanding that, you know, we cannot lose this fight this time.
Wow. And now to a quick musical break. This is Aztec Sun Band from Washington, D.C. with their song, In the Name of Everyone.
Stand in the name of everyone, Mother, Father, Son. tomorrow and you feel like the world has lost its way, look around at all the people.
That was Aztec Sun Band from Washington, D.C. with their song, In the Name of Everyone. And now, back to my conversation with Saisam Kam, an activist from Myanmar. We continued with me asking about what role he expects from the international community.
I must say that, you know, one of my observation is many of the placards that people are holding in the demonstration are in English.
Uh-huh.
And then there is a call for the UN and for the US intervention. And yeah, I mean, without belittling the courage of the people going out on the street and, you know, fighting there.
Yeah.
But still, there is a lot of kind of expectation to the UN and to the international community.
Uh-huh.
You know, if it is not too harsh, I would like to say there is kind of like a coloniality, you know,
uh-huh,
independence. Yeah. And this is something that we really have to, this movement really have to address. But having said that, I'm also observing that more and more people are started to see the limitation of international systems and the intervention. And now people are saying that we have to really think about that and we have to rely on ourselves. So that is that awakening, which is very encouraging for me, especially the younger generation, you know, before they saw Aung San Suu Kyi as the only savior, you know, and now people have started to see that it's a process. It's part of the history. And then we own this process. We own this struggle if we want to change the outcome of that, you know, and where we want to go as a nation. So that's why I think that moment is a rupture of history, and that is very important moment for Myanmar.
Wow. And so you've got all these people now coming together. They're feeling it's a moment of history. They're out on the streets, but they're really coming up against a massive machine, right? We've seen this in many places where there's a desire for democracy, but man, the people have the guns. The military has the guns. And stands in the way. Is there any vulnerability somewhere in the military establishment in how they're running the country? Are there some possible cracks that are giving a little bit of hope?
Myanmar military has some history of their own, you know, rebellion and attempted assassination of their own military leaders. But, you know, because of that experience, they also have their own check and balance system.
Yeah.
For example, they have their own military intelligence department. So they are also checking their own staff, you know, who is loyal or not. And on the other hand, they also have huge business incentive, you know, that they can be a shareholder of the military-owned businesses. And then if they are loyal and if they work hard and if they went up to the career ladder, if they have higher position, then they will get more benefit.
There's a massive economic incentive.
Yes, they can get legal share that they can get. And also they have their own personal private owned companies, you know, not in their names, but their children's name or their wife's names, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. So Myanmar's military is very much active in the economy.
Very much, from the rice that we eat every day, from the cigarettes that people smoke, to the beers that they enjoy in the evening, to the, you know, control of the seaport and running hotel and hospital, to telecommunication and oil and gas enterprises.
Wow.
Everyday life of the citizens is, the business is very much involved by the military.
So the military is essentially a mafia running a government
in its
in
parallel,
some
sort of.
Of the activists call them as a cartel, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the Daily Maverick in South Africa just published a paper showing the cartel in Zimbabwe, where I'm from. And
wow.
It's really essentially the military having civilian faces whom they provide with money, so they get public roles and they just distribute money. It seems to be like a common trope in many places where you have this dictatorship element,
yes.
The militarized element. We had our own coup in 2017 in Zimbabwe.
Wow.
And it's, yeah, you essentially have very much fluidity between business, politics, and the military. And that's...
Yeah,
that seems to be...
Yeah, exactly, the political economy questions in Myanmar.
Yeah.
If you look at the political debates in Myanmar, a lot is around political ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
And also ethnicity, you know, like federalism, ethnocentric federalism is the key debates in Myanmar
mm-hmm.
politics. But political economy is kind of like missing in the mainstream political debates. If you check the political parties, militaries, and there is another element in Myanmar politics is what we call ethnic armed organization too, right?
Mm-hmm. So what are some important new developments? I'm aware, or I've heard from you, that there's some new developments telling us a little bit more about how the military really is involved in Myanmar's economy. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, just recently there was an anonymous group hacking the Myanmar company registration department's data. And then they made it to public, and some activist groups are trying to get access to that and trying to understand what is going on there. You know, Myanmar military involvement in the business is not a secret, you know, it has been known, and many journalists are also trying to write about that
mm-hmm.
for some time. But this leak, you know, it's a trove of information involving company registration of 120,000 companies
mm-hmm.
and over 3,000 contracts, I think, and concession between the companies and the Myanmar government, as well as information related to military-owned companies and holdings.
Mm-hmm.
One group called Justice for Myanmar reported about the military-owned telecommunication, which is a joint venture between Myanmar military and the Vietnamese military-owned business.
Mm-hmm.
It is called Mitel. It's a huge telecommunication company.
Uh-huh.
And one of the leaked documents which these telecommunication service provider Mitel submitted to Myanmar Investment Commission has a projection, you know, for within 10 years, they are going to provide income for the military, $700 million.
Wow.
So it's a very significant number.
That is a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of money there. And also Myanmar Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative. One of the group is called Myanmar Alliance for Transparency and Accountability. They tried to look into the information and they found out Myanmar oil and gas sector is generating about $700 million for 2017 and 2018 fiscal year alone.
Wow.
You know, within 1 year, they are generating about $700 million from Total, from Petronas, from POSCO and
mm-hmm.
PTTEP. So it's, you know, when we talk about Myanmar military-owned business, it's not only them, you know, the whole network of global finances and
mm-hmm.
global huge companies are involved there.
And all this money is really staying amongst the military elite rather than serving the people of Myanmar.
Definitely. Some of these money went to military-owned companies. Some of that directly go to the military battalions as shareholders. But sometimes some of these monies are also go to the military departments because, for example, like they own the land. Mm-hmm. So like land rents by the companies directly go to the military. So wow. Somehow activist groups are saying that what we are seeing, like Rohingya genocide or conflict in the northern part of Myanmar, or the current violent crackdown against activists and political activists, you know, this kind of business, income from the business, are contributing to that. And not uh-huh. only that, you know, well, we are also seeing information related to even European companies, what they call is dual use goods, you know, like software, mm-hmm. mass surveillance, drone technologies even, accessed by the Myanmar military. So the global arm embargoes and the loopholes in there are really, really important to check.
So it's really a network, a web. You can imagine why then they would get so desperate to protect exactly. such massive levels of income.
Exactly. I think I would say there is that, you know, when you ask me about the hope, I would say this, you know, I didn't see the split between the, there is a potential, but for now we can't really see any concrete evidence of a breakup in the military ranks and file. But unlike 1988 coup, this time they are deeply involved in the global finances. So mm-hmm. we really think that the global community, international community, have a say now.
So something like sanctions, something like targeted yes. sanctions might actually yes. have an impact.
Yes, targeted sanction, regarding to oil and gas, Myanmar Alliance for Transparency and Accountability are calling for global conglomerates like Total, Petronas, POSCO, Chevron, Shell, to have a withholding account, you know, not to transfer mm-hmm. any money to the illegitimate junta, instead mm-hmm. to withhold that money and transfer it when Myanmar have a legitimate elected civilian government.
Uh-huh. Well, we can only hope that that happens, right? I think hope is the main thing here.
Exactly.
I mean, from where you're standing and you're looking at all of this, what does success look like? What would you like to see happen in Myanmar? What are your sentiments?
I would say, you know, there are hot issues at hand, or there are also long-term issues that Myanmar as a nation, as a society, have to look into. You know, mm-hmm. Yes, people are protesting on the street and security for them. You know, to maintain a civic space, you know, that people have the right to express their political viewpoints, to protest, to go on the street, and also security of the politicians. Mm-hmm. All of these are very important. And then they also need support, you know, like international support, like finances, safe spaces, solidarity, mm-hmm. and also advocacy. These are all important, but I think we also need to look into what Myanmar as a society, as a nation, want to see. You mm-hmm. know, one of my concern is when we talk about democratic transition in Myanmar, by and large, it's still very much focusing on the urban politic, you know. Uh-huh. What about the rural politic and rural democratization? You know, it's kind of like a different world. I came mm-hmm. from the rural area in Myanmar, and mm-hmm. I see the politics are very different. In the rural area, still largely in the ethnic minority area particularly, the patron-client mm-hmm. relationships are still very strong. There are different types of, you know, local militias. So people really have to, you know, thread carefully mm-hmm. among different stakeholders, power holders. And, you know, these are, this kind of patron-client relation, clientelism, is really a barrier to a democratic transition in Myanmar. This has mm-hmm. been considered very little in the mainstream political debates in Myanmar. So these are the things that we really have to look into. Mm-hmm. And then the second one is, as I have touched before, about the coloniality. You know, we really need decolonization in Myanmar political debates. If you look at the Burma chauvinism or Burma Buddhist supremacy that people are, you know, for particularly ethnic minority people, including the Indian descendant, Chinese descendant, Muslims and Rohingyas are talking about, I think is very much rooted in that colonial mentality, you know, that the Burma Buddhist majority hate the British colonialism, right? Imperialism, because it's exploited them and it's repressed them. But when they are in the power, they are acting exactly like colonial master. So when you look at the 70 years long civil war in the ethnic minority area, including conflict against the Rohingya people, I would say that it's an internal colonization, you know? And then they are acting exactly like the colonial master, thinking that they own this whole country and, you know, the ethnic minority will get whatever they want to give them. You know, that mentality have to be, you know.
So that really has to change.
Yeah, change that. And also from the ethnic people, they play very important role in Myanmar. And being an ethnic minority myself, I understand why there is an ethnocentric politic in Myanmar, but we really have to rethink about, you know, we have a word called Dan Yen Da, which means indigenous people. But if you really check the history of Myanmar, all of us are at one point in the history migrant people, you know, we migrated from the Tibetan plateaus into Myanmar and such. So, you know, the Dan Yen Da or the minority felt that the Burma majorities oppressed them. But from their side, they would see Indian and Chinese descendant, regardless of they live in Myanmar for over 200 years or 300 years, they still see
them as outsiders.
You know, they are guests, they are outsiders, and they are the owner of this nation. That kind of attitude really have to, you know, even among the minority, this has to be reflected. And coloniality among the civil society organization and political activists, this also have to be reflect, you know, like our overly depending on the financial support and other support from the Western countries and to the UN system. This is important in
civil society.
Yes. And, you know, globally, this is a criticism, isn't it, to have a celebrity human rights defender. You know, we celebrate. How do we celebrate Aung San Suu Kyi? Remember, we idolize her as an icon. I think that kind of practices also need to be reflect upon, you know, that in the end, it has to be based on the Myanmar people. So for the Myanmar activists and political activists and civil society, this is a high time for us to reflect and also really go back to the grassroots mobilization. And also, you know, from the urban base, we really have to expand, you know, our thinking and work in the rural and peripheral areas.
So even if there's success in this particular moment, it would really be the beginning of the actual work.
Exactly. So that is also my message to my colleagues in Myanmar, you know. People are really, you know, angry with this military coup, and they are putting all their efforts to fight this fight, you know, that they are fighting this to win. But I see it as a long-term thing, you know. We might we might win, but even that win will be translated into concrete results. It will take a long time and effort, you know, like patriarchism, for example, you know, to smash the patriarchism in Myanmar politics and in our daily lives, you know, that will take a long time. Again, this is a rupture in the history, and, you know, there is a heightening political awareness and a lot of awakenings, and we really have to take this opportunity.
So it really does feel like a beginning of something much bigger than
resistance. That's why, you know, that's why I'm really, really hopeful, you know, especially like the younger generation. Often they are being dismissed that, you know, in Myanmar, age and generation is a very, very important intersectionality. In the politics, if you are not an old man, old Buddhist man, you are kind of like irrelevant, you know. So many young generation are always dismissed. But you know, they forget about the history that the kind of like the father of the nation, father of Miss Aung San Suu Kyi, General Aung San, the independent fighter. He was just over 20, you know, when he started, just freshly coming out of the university when he established the military. And if we look at the successive, you know, the political movement in Myanmar, it's all started by the young people.
Yeah.
So now I'm seeing that, you know, young people are taking the lead, and there is kind of like a generational understanding also emerging that older generation are saying that now we see that, you know, they are responsible. They are really taking the lead. You know, with all these tragic things that we are seeing in Myanmar, it's also a very exciting and hopeful time.
You know, for me, it's like hearing you speak is, there's so many parallels between your story, the story of Myanmar, and the story of Zimbabwe, which is thousands of kilometers away, but we're dealing with very much the same. It's a systematic problem. It's local elites.
I think
it's ethnic differences that were created by coloniality. It's really, the stories are so connected. And we have to find these different threads and bring them together to show that it's a global systemic problem, you know?
Yeah, and also the neoliberal economy.
The neoliberal economy.
How it's linked with that, yeah. But if I may add, you know, about the sacrifices that the ordinary peoples made, you know, like you might heard about the 19 years old girls in Mandalay.
Yeah.
I mean, she's 19 years old, and on her Facebook, she said, "I donated my body, you know, my blood type is A, and I donated my blood at any time," you know, that is some weeks before.
Before she even died.
Yeah, before she died. And then she also told her friend that maybe our chat, this chat could be the last time, but I would like you to know that I love you so much. So, you know, she is from the ethnic Chinese community. Mm-hmm. And normally ethnic Chinese in Myanmar try to, you know, stay away from politics.
Yeah.
So that's why I think that this is very significant, you know. A 19-year-old girl think that freedom and democracy is a cause worth to give her own life.
Worth dying for.
Worth dying for, you know. And then we also see another woman in central Myanmar. She's a fruit seller, roadside fruit seller, you know. She's from the, you know, working class, working people.
Yeah.
She went to donate her food, you know. We saw a lot of that, you know. The ordinary people, they have very little, but they have so much to give.
And they're giving everything they have.
Yeah, and I just hope that when we talk about democratic goals, democratic transition, the political leaders will not forget their contributions, you know, not forget working people of Myanmar who contributed in this revolution.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Saisam. In the absence of strong institutions and a democratic tradition, the relationship between those who control the guns and those whom the people elect to lead them tends to be one fraught with tension and distrust. Nevertheless, the people of Myanmar have a right to choose how they want to be governed, and we stand in solidarity with them and all other people who are fighting for democracy the world over. I have been your host, Sean Macheza, in conversation with Saisam Kam, an activist and scholar from Myanmar. Thank you for listening this far. If you want to find out more about what's going on in Myanmar, check out our commentary series on the country, linked in the episode description, and sign up for our special Myanmar newsletter. If you have a moment, please have a listen to our podcast on alternative approaches to drug policy, with a special focus on peasant farmers in Myanmar. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to
podcast@tni.org. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to give us a rating or a review on whichever platform you're receiving this podcast from. An endorsement will help us to reach more people, and your feedback will help us to create better content for you. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for listening this far, and see you next time.